R.A. Rosenbaum here with another fun-filled episode of that 401k podcast. This week's topic, we're going to talk about quirky 401k plan rules that plan sponsors should know, some interesting tidbits that, rules that you can't believe that there are actually there, or, you know, are there, kind of quirky, but maybe they do make sense. But of course, first things first, go to that 401ksite.com for further information on all our events. We got a virtual event at the end of January. I think it's the 25th and 26th. We're going to probably start around noonish, maybe 11 o'clock. We'll see how that goes. Probably end 2-3 o'clock. And it certainly should be interesting with that. We're working on the presentations and whatnot. A lot of good plan providers. And it's free if you get one of my emails. Click the Zoom link, sign up for free. If not, go to thatformargaysite.com, spend a couple dollars and be part of it. And of course, working on the May and June events. May is May 3rd, Arlington, Texas. June the 7th, I want to say, in the Bronx, New York. Been adding some new plan providers as sponsors. And of course, if you're a plan provider and you want to sponsor one of our events, we're running this thing where if you book a live event, you get to speak at the virtual event for free. But let's go to the topic at hand, episode 277. I've been doing this 401k stuff for 25 years now. Started September 98. Working for Berman Sussman Forsetter, the law firm associated with Mobius Tech, which eventually became Siebens Retirement Services, Inc. That's where I started. And, there's quirks in the law. I mean, law constantly changing, what happened in 1998, and then now a lot of things have happened. Safe Harbor, Roth, 401k, all that kind of good stuff. And there's still some rules. Actually, most of these rules that we're going to talk about are rules that have been going on and on and on. They've been around since the beginning of time. So even before I had any notion of being an ERISA attorney. And obviously, number one concept, fiduciary responsibility. I don't know, but I don't watch the shows, but I like to read about airplane crashes and whatnot. And I remember years ago... long time ago, I want to say about 15 years ago, I was reading an article that someone had written that there is no point to the safety precautions on a water landing because the fuselage would be broken up. There's no point to it. You're not likely to survive. And then I want to say a little less than a year or two later was Flight 1549 U.S. Airways. I was working that day at Penn Station, near Penn Station, at that semi-prestigious law firm. And I remember popping up, there's a plane in the Hudson. And I remember that day because you could hear the sirens go down 34th Street because they were getting to the Hudson. They were going all the way to the west side. And, once I saw pictures that the plane was above water, you knew that there were going to be a lot of survivors. And, of course, as you know, with any airplane crash or whatever it is, even if you see Airport 79, the Concorde, when people escape a plane, the captain is the last one off the ship, last one off the plane, make sure there are no other passengers. And that's what Sully did that day. It's a great story. Even a really good movie directed by Clint Eastwood with Tom Hanks playing Sully. He walked a couple times up and down the aircraft to make sure there were nobody left. Last one off the plane. That's what we say about the last one off the ship with a sinking ship. And I remember there was the story of an Italian liner where the captain was not the last one off the ship. I think it was the band director was the last one off the ship. This was sometime in the early 90s or late 80s or whatnot. But 401k plan sponsors kind of like that in terms of responsibility. When you're holding your own money and you lose it, that's your fault. When you're holding the money of your employees, obviously you have the highest duty of care and equity in law. You got to be a little bit more responsible. So, you know, the buck will always remain with the plan sponsor. Even if you delegate fiduciary responsibility to other plan providers, like a 316 administrator or a 338 fiduciary, it's there. You're still on the hook for hiring them. So, Jeff Ritchie Vantage Benefits, they were also a 316 administrator. You know, you're on the hook for hiring the guy. Probably should have Googled and found out that he was banned from the securities business by the SEC. You know, but in terms of fiduciary responsibility, you could always minimize it. You can never truly, truly eliminate it. And that's a quirky rule, in my opinion, because a lot of times the errors are the fault of the plan providers. TPAs make a lot of mistakes, especially bad ones. So that there's always an issue. ADP ACB discrimination testing to me has always been a quirk. I find it to be a quirk. To be a qualified retirement plan means you got to meet the qualification requirements of 401A of the Internal Revenue Code. And, you know, to be qualified means there's tax-deferred treatment on contributions, solid deferrals, of course, unless you paid taxes up front and you had it as a Roth. To get that tax-deferred, tax-qualified treatment of your trust, you got to abide by the 401k plan rules, 401A rules, where 401k falls under. And to be qualified, you have to meet these requirements, and you can't discriminate. When we hear the word discrimination, we always have the idea of, you know, something like Jim Crow, you know, people, you know, African Americans couldn't drink out of the water fountain or something as dumb as that. We're not talking about discriminating people on a racial classification or gender or sexual orientation. We're talking about discrimination in retirement plans, that the plans shouldn't discriminate in favor of highly compensated employees. And again, we're not talking about, you know, treating HCDs better than NHCs, as, you know, the Jim Crow laws or some gender-based rules or even, you know, anti-LGBT legislation would, you know, unfairly impact members of the LGBT community. ADP and ACP testing doesn't, you know, it's not as nefarious. It's just a test on the ADP side, obviously deferrals, ACP the match. And that 2% thing always gets to me, that HCEs can't defer more than 2% of the NHCEs. I don't like that rule. First of all, you know, somebody making $155,000 in 2024, I don't think that they're highly compensated. I mean, if they live in New York or they live in San Francisco or Boston or Los Angeles, they're not really well off. But the Internal Revenue Code says that they're highly compensated. And the nuance of in an ADP situation is people who make more can afford to defer more. So my daughter works at the local pizzeria. Now, if they had a 401k plan, you know, the guy, you know, my daughter's doing okay as a high school student, but, you know, there are people there making, you know, $16 to $20 an hour. That's not money, especially living on Long Island, where you could afford to defer a 401k plan in addition to paying rent or whatever their situation is. So, you know, it's just this kind of quirk that's not, you know, I don't think it's fair. You know, and of course people are going to say, well, Ari doesn't think it's fair in favor of people who are making $155,000. I like the 403B universal availability requirement rule. You have everybody eligible to defer. We don't have an ADP test. We like that. It's just that, you know, the fact that HCs can defer more than a 2% clip than the NHCs, I don't find that to be discrimination. I just find that to be reality. But, you know, again, I don't set the rules. And then, of course, people will point out that if we didn't have these rules, then we wouldn't have safe harbor contributions, then we wouldn't have, you know, qualifying non-elective contributions for the employers that just didn't want to have refunds to the HCEs. I understand the rules. I just don't think it's, you know, exactly right. And again, some businesses are going to have a problem demographically of always passing the test, because, you know, the owner and his wife who own the pizzeria they're going to be able to defer a lot more, and I bet you they're the only people that are highly compensated in the plan. And I don't even think they make $155,000 because there's some solid partners involved. But they're, you know, HCs because they're 5% owners. It's not, you know, like I said, it's not something that is fair. I just, you know, that's just to me, you know, again, as somebody who did make, you know, $155,000 at one point, I don't think that's living large. But, you know, again, these are the rules that we have to live with, and I just do think it's a quirk. Next on my hit list, the successor plan rule. When a plan sponsor sets up a 401k plan, the idea is that it's not a one-done type of thing. You know, there's this kind of permanency requirement. You're supposed to have the plan in place for a couple of years. It really, we use the term 3 years. So I remember years ago, there was a lawyer who had a SEP plan, and he asked me if there was a better plan out there, and because he was getting a huge settlement. Turns out he was above age 65. I told him to do a defined benefit plan, and of course the idea was you got to have that plan 3 years in a row. You can't just have this defined benefit plan pump up, take that deduction, and then just terminate the next year. Terminating a plan obviously has that nuance that participants are fully vested in their contributions and can withdraw their account to cash or transfer to another plan or to an IRA. Defined benefit plans, you know, we terminate them all the time. People buy NRA, no need to keep the plan around. We terminate it. 401k plans, just like 403b plans, has this quirky successor plan rule that throws up everybody here and there. And, you know, the successor plan rule was created to avoid situations to which a plan sponsor would try some sort of loophole around the plan rules and get a distribution of their deferrals or, you know, avoid some ADP and ACP complication or, you know, or just, you know, jettisoning the plan and starting one anew. We have that successor plan rule that, you know, terminating a 401k plan, they can't terminate a 401k plan and then start a new one. They have to wait 12 months in order, you know, to have the successor plan or, you know, you can't have, if you do the successor plan, you can't have termination payments and whatnot. And a plan is not considered a successor plan if during a 24-month period that begins 12 months before the termination date, less than 2% of employees who are eligible under the terminated plan are eligible for the new plan, or another plan in the employer able to receive the terminating plan's assets. The plan is maintained by a different employer, or the plan is a SEP, a simple IRA, 403B, 457, 457S, or an ESOP. So, you know, it's a quirk in order to avoid the situation where, again, employees can simply, you know, terminate the plan, get a distribution, and start again. And so if you set up a new plan, you either can't have the new plan or you can't have the termination. It's like one or the other. It always reminds me of the movie Casino. You could have the money or you could have the hammer, but you can't have both or something like that. You can have the money and the hammer or you can walk out. And the guy elected to walk out. When he was cheating the casino. So that's your, you know, choice. It's a Sophie's choice. You continue the plan or you have the termination. You can't have both. And it really comes up a lot. Comes up a lot in mergers or stock sales. You know, they it was a stock purchase and they want to terminate the old plan because, you know, the old owners, we don't know what they did with the plan, that sort of nonsense. And so that successor plan rule does rear its ugly head every now and then. I just have the situation where it did come up recently to avoid really issues. You can, you know, transfer the deferrals to the successor plan or leave the money in the terminated plan until there's a valid distributable event. mothball it. But, you know, to have a situation where he can't have a plan for a year, that to me doesn't seem like a lot of fun. And you lose on that opportunity to save quite a bit of money for that year that, you know, the plan is out. Last but not least, a big quirk is the contingent benefit rule. Salary deferrals are, you know, really a big part of the 401k plan. So for most situations and most plans out there, salary deferrals can be the only contribution made to the plan. So, there's a situation where you may want to incentivize people to participate in the 401k component of the plan or not. But outside of matching contributions and a couple of quirky new changes, you can't. Under the contingent benefit rule, you can't directly or indirectly condition any other benefit with limited exceptions, including, again, matching or that de minimis financial incentive that's not played with plan assets, those gift card ideas that we have as part of the new SECURE Act, on an election to defer or not to defer. So that came up one time when I was working at that semi-prestigious law firm. There was a situation dealing with an employer contribution, a retroactive contribution that would have gone in on the deferral part of the plan, but it was going to be based on the fact that they would make the contribution only if people did not defer the plan. You know, kind of like this cash deal. They were going to try to funnel this nice union benefit that they were getting and try to funnel into the 401k plan. It just didn't work out because of the contingent benefit rule. I think the idea was, we'll give you the contribution, but you can't defer in the plan for that year. We'll get you up to the, you know, 415 limits, or it was something like that. And I said, guys, I can't work out. Got this contingent benefit rule. And that put a stop to it. We do have that new de minimis benefit rule that, you know, I don't know many people are doing it, but if you wanted to give somebody a gift card to incentivize them to participate in the plan, or, you know, something that's de minimis, you know, $25, $50, and not paid out of plan assets, it now can be done. So again, you know, you want to give everybody the Amazon gift card for showing up at these deferral meetings and have them actively participate. Yeah, now you can do it. Violating the contingent benefit rule is one of those basic rules that can get your plan disqualified, and I think that's a silly way to get disqualified for. And, you know, you can't offer, you know, that you can't wet their beak, wet the participant's beak in a situation to have them defer or not defer outside of, again, that match contribution, de minimis benefits, or, you know, they have the, I guess it's a exception is to pay off student loans. Again, I don't see that many employers want to put that in there. I just did get my student loan payment invoice just today. So those are some of the quirky rules with 401k plans. So, you learn something new every day. A lot of it does make sense. Again, I think the successor plan rule is one that certainly makes sense. Contingent benefit, you don't want any kind of like nefarious situation where, you know, we incentivize people to not defer in the plan. Like, you know, somebody could say, I'll give you $1,000 if you don't defer and the plan is a safe harbor match. You don't want to have a situation like that where, you know, you got these indecent proposals about, you know, people not deferring in the plan or, you know, trying to push them to defer. We have automatic enrollment. We have so many different gimmicks and safe harbor plan design that a plan sponsor truly doesn't have to go into a bag of tricks and devise some kind of nefarious idea on how we're going to have people defer or not defer in a 401k plan. So I hope you enjoy this episode of that 401k podcast. I think when the episode drops that morning, I will be on the road to Sunrise, Florida to go see hopefully I get tickets for the Panthers against the New York Rangers. And tape a week in advance here. But I don't know if we really tape, if we don't have tape, since everything's now digital, but I still use the word tape. So tune in next week for another episode of the F1K Podcast, our first of 2024. We'll try to figure out how many weeks it'll be where I'll still write 2023 on the checks. But they're not even writing checks anymore, you know, the whole situation where my neighborhood, of course, everybody's like washing these checks. They steal from the post box and, you know, wash out checks. So now I'm doing everything through ACH anyway. But tune in for the 2024 first of the year. We'll have it for you. And, of course, go to that 401ksite.com for further information on all our events. Thanks. Bye.